Tonight we begin with the first verse of the third chapter of Zechariah. We have looked at the first two chapters in our first session, and already I'm sure you have discovered that this is a very provocative book, very different than perhaps you might have thought when you read it at first glance, because it is a prophetic book, a messianic book, and it has to do with specifics about the coming of Jesus into the world as the Messiah of the Jews and the Savior of the world. And we've already pointed out some of those passages in the first two chapters, and we'll, of course, be looking at some more tonight and throughout the remainder of our study of this book. Zechariah chapter 3. Let me read a few verses, which I don't usually do at the beginning, but tonight I think maybe I should, because Zechariah is difficult to read, even at just a first cursory reading. It's a little difficult because at first it doesn't seem to make too much sense. So let me help you get the feel of the passage by reading several verses. And he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him. And the Lord said unto Satan, The Lord rebuke thee, O Satan. Even the Lord, who hath chosen Jerusalem, rebuke thee. Is not this a brand plucked out of the fire? Now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments, and stood before the angel. And he answered and spoke unto those who stood before him, saying, Take away the filthy garments from him. And to him he said, Behold, I have caused thine iniquity to pass from thee, and I will clothe thee with change of raiment. And I said, Let them set a clean turban upon his head. So they set a clean turban upon his head, and clothed him with garments, and the angel of the Lord stood by. And the angel of the Lord protested unto Joshua, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, If thou wilt walk in my ways, and if thou wilt keep my charge, then thou shalt also judge my house, and shalt also keep my courts, and I will give thee places to walk among these who stand by. Hear now, O Joshua, the high priest, thou and thy fellows who sit before thee, for they are men wondered at. For behold, I will bring forth my servant, the branch. For behold, the stone that I have laid before Joshua, upon one stone shall be seven eyes. Behold, I will engrave the engraving of it, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. In that day, saith the Lord of hosts, shall ye call every man his neighbor under the vine and under the fig tree. I have read you the third chapter, which has only 10 verses in it, a short chapter. But as you can see, it's not very stimulating to read at first blush, is it? Let's go back now to the first verse of this chapter. And he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him. You need to note at the outset that in this chapter, chapter 3, what we have presented to us in this vision, and remember there are 8 of these visions in the book of Zechariah, what we have presented to us in this vision in chapter 3 is the nation of Israel represented by the high priest Joshua. And this was literally true. Joshua was the name of the high priest at this time, at this juncture in the life of the nation of Israel. And he represents the nation, as the high priest always did. But in a very specific and profound way, in the book of Zechariah, he represents the nation. Also, I should like for you to note that it is significant, I think, that the name of the high priest in 520 B.C., when this book was written, or began to be written, that the high priest named Joshua had a name which was identical with the name of the Messiah, whom he represented as the Savior of his nation who was yet to come. In the Old Testament, you come across the name Joshua, first of all, in the book of Exodus, where Joshua becomes the military chieftain of Moses and is responsible for directing the warfare against the Canaanites, which eventually ensued in capturing the land of Canaan for the people who had come out of Egyptian bondage. This is not the same Joshua. This is another Joshua. And this man is not a military man. This man is an ecclesiastical man. He is the high priest. And as the high priest, he represents the nation, but in a more profound way, he represents the Messiah, who is to be identified with the nation when he comes the first time, and eventually, even more significantly, when he comes the second time to establish the nation which had rejected him the first time as the approved nation during the millennium. Now, this chapter has to do with that whole concept, and also, additionally, it has to do with the truth that the people of Israel were like a priest with filthy garments because they had been unfaithful to the God who had called them and who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, they were like people with filthy garments on. In the New Testament, we read about Christianity being an experience where one lays aside his old garments and puts on new white garments of righteousness. It's the same analogy which is used here in the Old Testament for the nation of Israel under the figure of the man Joshua. And I think the fact that Joshua and Jesus, and the word in the Hebrew is Jeshua or Yeshua, and incidentally, that's the way the Jews still pronounce Jesus. The Jews pronounce his name Yeshua, J-E-S-H-U-A. That is transliterated into English in the Old Testament as Joshua, and in the New Testament as Jesus. So it's one and the same word in each instance. And I find more, I'm like the prophet at this point, I find more here than I can quite fully understand in the fact that the high priest of Israel, or Judah, in 520 B.C., who represents the nation, has the same name as the high priest of all of us who now intercedes for us in heaven and eventually will return as the high priest, the king and the priest of the nation of Israel at the end of the age. There's so much more in the scriptures than you can ever begin to fully comprehend. Even if you dig and you dig and you dig, you discover that there are still traces of great truth below what you have dug into. And especially is that true in a book so mysterious in some ways as is the book of Zechariah. So, we begin chapter 3 with the consciousness that the nation of Israel has rebelled against its God and will eventually reject its Messiah the first time. It has failed in its mission to be the light of the world, the light to the Gentiles, to bring all people unto God, and it has proclaimed its satisfaction with its self-righteousness. So here God, in this vision which Zechariah has, is seeking to help the people cast aside, first of all, recognize their self-righteousness, and then cast aside their self-righteousness and accept the true righteousness of God in the Messiah which is to come for the establishing of their nation and their kingdom. So he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord. And remember that the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament is always a figure which means the Messiah, the pre-incarnate appearance of the Messiah, the Savior. We've seen that again and again throughout the books of the Old Testament, especially the book of Genesis, where the angel of the Lord appeared quite often to men like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is a pre-incarnate appearance of the Son of God. This is what we call a theophany. And God appears in some special way, some visual way, apparently, unto some special people. So he's standing before the Messiah, and Satan is standing at his right hand to resist him. I find that interesting because in the book of Job, which is probably the oldest book that we have in the Bible, in the book of Job, when the devil comes to appear before God to accuse Job, and to say to God, you have built a hedge about him, you're protecting him, or he wouldn't be such a good man. Give me a chance and I'll show you what he's made of. When he appears before God, he appears with the host of heaven. He appears with all of the angelic beings. And he stands in their presence, in the presence of God. And when God asks him where he has come from, he says, I've come from going to and fro throughout the whole earth. And you will notice later in the book of Zechariah that God himself is portrayed as one who goes to and fro throughout the whole earth. So what we have here is the counterpart to God. We have God and we have Satan. And Satan is given a name in the Old Testament and in the New Testament and by Jesus Christ, which indicates to us without any question that Satan is not a figure of speech. He is not something abstract, but he's very concrete. He is a person. He is very real. And today you will hear some who seek to teach the Bible who will try to make you understand or think that Satan is just some abstract of evil in the world and that it's not a personality. But it is a personality. It's a personality who's pitted against God. And he's very active, even presenting himself in the presence of God to accuse us. The Bible tells us that he accuses us before God day and night. And that, incidentally, is why we need Jesus Christ as our high priest to intercede for us before the Father in heaven. So here we find a specific reference to Satan in the book of Zechariah, as we have found in the book of Isaiah, and as you find throughout, of course, the New Testament. And he's in the presence of God, standing before the Messiah. And he should be Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him, to, if he can, keep Joshua, the representative of the nation of Israel, from casting aside the self-righteousness of the people and adopting the righteousness of God. And the Lord said unto Satan, the Lord rebuke thee. Now this is when the Lord is used, sometime it refers to the Messiah and sometime it refers to the Father. The Lord speaks to the Lord. The Messiah speaks to the Father. The Lord said unto Satan, the Lord rebuke thee, O Satan, even the Lord who hath chosen Jerusalem, rebuke thee. So this is a petition on the part of the Messiah to God to rebuke Satan, because God has chosen Jerusalem and Satan has no right to Jerusalem or to this people. Is not this a brand plucked out of the fire? Which not only is a reference to the plucking of Joshua as the high priest and a certain number of people out of Babylonian captivity and allowing them to go back under the decree of Cyrus first and then Darius to the land of Israel to rebuild their temple. Not only that, but plucked out of the fires of divine judgment, so that God allows Joshua to be a representative of a kind of remnant who has escaped the final judgment of God and is given another opportunity, a brand plucked out of the burning. Now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and stood before the angel. This was the condition of Israel, Judah, I should say, because Israel is identified, yes, with the whole nation, but it's identified with the northern kingdom after they fell. This is the southern kingdom we're talking about, Judah, but we sometimes still refer to it as Israel, because all Israel, Paul says, is going to be saved, by which he doesn't mean every individual Israelite, but he means the totality of the nation of Israel, the full 12 tribes, not just the tribe of Judah. So Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and stood before the Lord, representing the nation of Israel. Now this is a little difficult for us to conceive or imagine that the high priest would be standing in filthy garments before the Lord of all the earth, because that was something, of course, the high priest didn't do. When the high priest went into the Holy of Holies once a year to stand before the Lord, he went and dressed in a very immaculate and special way to be presented before the God of all the earth. And this is why I guess I still come from kind of an old traditional school in which, though I know it's all right for us to come to church on Sunday morning in our blue jeans, I still think there's something proper about coming into the presence of God to worship the King of the earth dressed appropriately. I don't want to make a big issue of that because that's not theological. That's woodsonology, but somehow it just seems to me that that's the proper way for us to do. But this high priest is dressed in this vision in filthy garments to represent something. He represents the nation of Israel, which now is beginning to come out of Babylonian captivity, but which is like a filthy garment because of its sin. And he answered and spoke unto those who stood before him, saying, take away the filthy garments from him. And unto him he said, behold, I have caused thine iniquity to pass from thee, and I will clothe thee with a change of raiment. Two things I want to say about this verse. The first is, here we see God pardoning the nation of Israel. Out of his free grace, he pardons the nation of Israel, and even though they're in filthy garments, he wants to clean them up, and he gives them a chance to start again. So he says, take away his filthy garments, which is representative of what I'm about to do for the nation eventually. And behold, I have caused thine iniquity, speaking to Joshua as the representative of the people, I have caused your iniquity to pass from you. You notice that in the Old Testament, salvation ultimately, finally, really, was justification, and salvation was by faith, just as it is in the New Testament. It is true that they had a sacrificial system and they had a system of moral law, but ultimately their salvation depended upon their faith. And that's why even in the book of Genesis, it is said of Abraham, he believed God, and that was imputed to him for righteousness. So God has always saved his people as a result of their faith, not by what they did, but what they believed, or whether they took him at his word. And here it is again. It's free grace that God gives to them on the basis of their faith. And unto him he said, behold, I've caused your iniquity to pass from you. I've imputed righteousness to you. I know that you're filthy in your sin, but I'm going to take your filthy rags off, and I'm going to dress you up, and I'm going to treat you like you've never sinned against me, like I've never been displeased with you, like you've never been in captivity. I'm going to treat you like you're mine. That's grace. Grace, how lovely and how beautiful is the grace of God. And I will clothe thee with a change of raiment. And I said, let them set a clean turban upon his head. Now, the high priest, or the priest, not just the high priest, but the high priest in particular, wore a turban upon his head. A turban is just what you think it was. Sometimes it's called in the Old Testament Hebrew a mitre. But that does not represent a mitre as we see the Pope wear, the pointed mitre up on his head. It's simply an Old Testament word that means a turban, and the turban was cloth which was wrapped around and around the head, like a turban is today. But the significant thing about the turban which the high priest wore was upon the front of the turban were the words printed in Hebrew, holiness to the Lord. So the fact that God has pardoned the high priest as a representative of the people, significantly suggesting to him that this is what he wants to do with the nation itself. He has imputed righteousness to the nation in spite of its filthiness. He's removed the nation's filthy garments, and now he's put a turban which says holiness to the Lord upon the head of this high priest who had had the filthy garments on him. Means that indeed, in every way, this is the righteousness of God which he has given as an act of cleansing to the nation of Israel. And he's doing this after the captivity in 520 B.C. as they began to return. So they set a clean turban upon his head and clothed him with garments, and the angel of the Lord stood by. The angel of the Lord is the Messiah. And the angel of the Lord protested unto Joshua. That is, the angel of the Lord said, all right, Joshua, we see what God has symbolically done for the nation in dressing you up and cleaning you up. But I want to remind you, Joshua, that God expects something of you. He expects you to cast off your self-righteousness as a nation, as a people, and he expects you to be different. And this is what he expects. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, if thou wilt walk in my ways, and if thou wilt keep my charge, then thou shalt also judge my house, and shalt also keep my courts, and I will give thee places to walk among these who stand by. Which probably is a direct reference to the angelic beings which are mentioned throughout Zechariah, but could be a reference to the nations of the world which stand by during the millennial reign and watch as God's people become the high priestly nation they were originally intended to be. But they have to, in order to keep his charge and to judge his house, the world, they have to walk in his ways and keep themselves clean. Now hear, O Joshua, the high priest, thou and thy fellows who sit before thee, for they are men wondered at. For behold, I will bring forth my servant, the branch. The branch. And in my Bible, it is in capital letters. Of course, in the Hebrew, there are no capitals or small case. Everything is the same. But here, for emphasis, the translators have capitalized the word, and the word is branch. In Isaiah, and let me turn back to it, in Isaiah chapter 4, verse 2, and you don't need to turn to it now, you may want to make a note and read it when you get home, where Isaiah the prophet, before the time of Zechariah, Isaiah the prophet speaks about the coming of the Messiah to the nation of Israel, and he says, in that day shall the branch of the Lord be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are established, for them that are escaped, pardon me, of Israel. So this is the first mention we have in the Old Testament of the branch. Isaiah calls the Messiah, who is to come to the nation of Israel, the branch of the Lord. Zechariah here calls him the branch. Now what does that mean? In the scriptures, we hear Jesus referred to, the Messiah referred to, as the root and offspring of David, which means that he is both the father of David and the son of David. How can that be? That can be only because Jesus Christ is God incarnate in human flesh. He is divine and he is human. Not half and half, but fully God and fully man. And as such, being fully God, he was the creator or the father of David. But being fully man, he is the descendant of David, thus the son of David. So it is the divine Savior who is the son of David, who will someday once again occupy the throne of David as the promise is given throughout the Old Testament, even from the time of Abraham in the book of Genesis. Now, the branch is another word to describe the Messiah or the Savior. He is the root and the offspring of David. He is the branch. Now, if God were a tree, and of course I'm simply using an analogy here. If God were a tree, and that is what we're talking about when we talk about a branch, if God is a tree, then his son, Jesus Christ, is a branch, or the branch, the main branch of that tree. So he's called a branch here. He is God's own branch. He has God's own nature. He is God's own son. He is one of a kind. He is unique. He is monogenes, as John 3:16 puts it, the unique, only begotten son of God. No other one like him. He is the main branch. And it is this branch that is eventually going to come to Israel and is going to be her king, her priest and her king, Joshua and Zerubbabel. And later we'll hear about Zerubbabel in the passage in chapter 4, because Zerubbabel is the other of the two witnesses which are mentioned in these verses. So I will bring forth my servant, the branch. For behold, the stone that I have laid before Joshua. Now, please be careful, because here Zechariah mixes his metaphors. He talks about Jesus as the branch, and in the next breath, he talks about him as the stone. And if you're not familiar with the background of these words in the Old Testament and how they've been used there and in the New Testament as well, then you're apt to miss the whole point. When you move from he who will be called the branch to the stone that is placed before Joshua the high priest, you get terribly confused and mixed up. You don't know where you are. But the stone also is a metaphor or an analogy for Jesus Christ. He is the stone which the builders rejected and which has now become the head of the corner. He is the foundation stone, or he is, better still, the keystone of the arch, which keeps the whole thing from collapsing. When he said to Simon Peter, I say unto thee that thou art Peter, and upon this rock thou art Petros, and upon this rock Petra I will build my church. He was talking about himself. You are a stone, Peter, because of your confession. But upon this rock, myself, this stone, I will build my church. So stone throughout the scripture represents Jesus Christ too. He is the branch, and he is the stone. Now I believe it's in Daniel. I sometimes have to stop and think where these passages are. It's in Daniel in the Old Testament, where we're told that at the end of the age, when God does his final military battle against the evil forces of the world, that there will be a stone which will come rolling down the mountainside and will destroy all of these kingdoms of the world and set up a new kingdom of righteousness. That stone is the Messiah. So here, when he refers to the branch, he's talking about Jesus. When he refers to the stone, he's talking about Jesus. And he says to Joshua the high priest, the stone that I have laid before Joshua, upon one stone shall be seven eyes. And always when you have the word seven in the scriptures, it has some divine meaning, some perfection in it. Seven is the number of perfection. It is God's number. Man's number is six. He's a little short of God. Even though God made it in his image, he's short of God. God's number is seven, which is the number of perfection. So when the seven eyes are mentioned, you know that the stone has something to do with God. And the seven eyes are mentioned later in the next chapter and have to do with the omniscience of God, for his eyes go to and fro throughout the whole earth. Behold, I will engrave the engraving of it. Now, this is a difficult a difficult sentence, a difficult statement here, but I think I know what it means. Let me take a stab at it. He's talking about the Messiah, who is the stone and the branch, the stone that will come down the mountainside, destroy the kingdoms of the earth. But he's talking about the Messiah, who, first of all, when he comes to Israel, will be rejected and will be nailed to a cross, crucified, because they do not accept God's solution for their sin. But then he will come back the second time as the mighty stone. But here the stone, which will return the second time in power and great glory, has an engraved upon it. Something has been cut into it. What is that? I think that here we see the prophet with a vision of the crucifixion of Christ, or what happened to the stone on Calvary's cross. The nail prints in the hands, the nail prints in the feet, the wound in the side, the crown of thorns upon his head, the engraving which God has done to the stone, the scars, the markings of his crucifixion for us upon Calvary's cross. I think that's what is meant here. And I don't believe that's a stretch, because throughout the book, Zechariah sees some very, very intricate and detailed things about the Messiah. And he tells us about them. The stone, upon one stone shall be seven eyes. Behold, I will engrave the engraving of it, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. I will remove the iniquity of that land, which is, of course, Israel, the nation of Israel. This is talking about the end times when the nation is regathered. I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. That is the day of the Lord. And that's the expression used throughout the Old Testament, the day of the Lord, quote unquote, which is always a reference to the final day of judgment, when God will rout the forces of evil, destroy sin in every form, and will establish his kingdom of righteousness through his Son. In that day, there it is, in that day, saith the Lord of hosts, shall you call every man his neighbor under the vine and under the fig tree. Now, it's the prophet Micah in chapter 4, verse 4, who first of all talks about the nation of Israel as being a place where every man will sit under his vine and his fig tree, which is an analogy for security and protection and prosperity. It simply is a reference to the millennium, when there will be no more fear, there will be no more want, but the nation of Israel will be great and strong and powerful, and the deserts will blossom like the rose, and the people of Israel will be restored, and every man will have his own vine, and every man will have his own fig tree in the millennium. And the angel who talked with me came again and waked me as a man that is wakened out of his sleep. And we don't have any problem at this point wondering why he was taking a nap, because he was literally worn out with all these visions. And said unto me, what seest thou? In every vision, all of these eight visions, that's the way the interpreting angel speaks. He says to Zechariah, what do you see, Zechariah? Tell me what you see. What do you see? And I said, I have looked, and behold, I see a lampstand, all of gold, with a bowl upon the top of it, and seven lamps on it, and seven pipes to the seven lamps which are upon the top of it. Now, what did he see? This is what he saw. Let me draw you a picture. Where's my eraser? Who runs off of my eraser all the time? Here it is. Let me draw you a picture of this lampstand that he saw. The lampstand, and I'm going to have to start at the bottom, so I can't get out of everybody's way. I'm doing my best. But he sees a lampstand here, which is simply the lampstand as it was always in the tabernacle, and it was made of seven individual fingers or lights, like that. This was the lampstand. But he says he sees something a little different about the lampstand. He sees a bowl above the lampstand, on the top of the lampstand. So we've got a big bowl up here. And the bowl has oil in it. The oil is to feed the lampstand. Now, in Israel, in olden days, of course, it was fed by oil, which was replenished day by the priest, and the priest was responsible for keeping it lighted. But this is something different. There's a bowl above the lampstand, and he sees seven pipes to each of the lamps. Now, I can't put them all up here, see, because I haven't got room. But he sees seven pipes from the bowl to each of the lights, of the seven lights. So there's 49 pipes, whatever that may mean, I'm not sure. There are 49 pipes which feed the oil from the bowl. Then he says a little later that he sees two olive trees standing beside the lamp. So here we are with our trees again, and he sees two of them. two trees, and these trees have from them pipes to the bowl. Now, this is a vision. This is a vision. This is what he sees in his vision. It's almost a nightmare, isn't it? But this is what he sees. And these pipes run from these olive trees into the bowl and feed the bowl, keep it full. And the bowl feeds each of the lights. Now, that's what he saw. And it's no wonder that when the angel said, "Do you understand what you saw?" he said, "I don't have the foggiest idea." That's what he said about every one of the visions. When the angel said, "Do you understand what you see?" and he would say, "No, I don't understand what I see." Now let's look at it. "What seest thou?" And I said, "I have looked, and behold, a lampstand all of gold with a bowl upon the top of it, and there's seven lamps on it, and seven pipes to the seven lamps which are upon the top of it, and two olive trees by it, one upon the right side of the bowl, and the other upon the left side of it." So I answered and spoke to the angel who talked with me, saying, "What are these? What is this I'm looking at?" And the angel who talked with me answered and said, "Do you not know? I'm surprised. Do you not understand this? Do you not know what these are?" And I said, "No, my Lord." Then he answered and spoke unto me, saying, "This is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel." Now, who is Zerubbabel? We haven't heard of him in Zechariah before. Zerubbabel was the, we might call him the governor. He was the civil head, and Joshua was the ecclesiastical head of the people of Israel in Babylonian captivity at this time. See, they had a high priest. They couldn't function as they had normally functioned, of course, in a strange land, but they still had a civil head, somebody who was in charge of them, somebody with whom the king could speak, and somebody with whom the priest could speak. So Zerubbabel was the civil head or the governor, and he was the one who, in the first return, the little dribble of people who returned from Babylonian captivity, the first time into the land of Israel to rebuild their temple, their altar, and then their temple, he was the one who went with them and helped them to establish the work, Zerubbabel. So he is representative of the king of Israel, and Joshua is representative of the priest. So here you have the two olive trees, Joshua, the high priest, and Zerubbabel, the king, the two representatives of God in the nation of Israel as they are about to be restored to their land. This is what he sees. "Then he answered and spoke unto me, saying, This is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel, saying, Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts." And how many times have you heard that quoted? Out of context. You know, preachers quote that at times to say what is right, but totally out of context, because they don't usually refer back to where it comes from and what it's talking about. What God is saying to Zechariah here, and Zechariah is saying to Joshua the high priest and the people, is don't be deceived, because even though the high priest Joshua and Zerubbabel, the governor, are my two representatives here and are responsible, as it were, for keeping the oil in the bowl so that the lights in my nation of Israel is supposed to be a lampstand, a light to the world, keeping the lights lighted, don't forget that it isn't Zerubbabel and Joshua who are the origin of this power or this light. It is not by might nor by power. It is not by priests nor by kings, but it is by the Spirit of God that these things can be. Don't forget that, Zechariah. Don't forget that, church. It's not by our power. It's not by our maneuvering. It's not by our machinery. It is by the Spirit of God that these things can be. Otherwise, it cannot be at all. "Who art thou, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel thou shalt become a plain, and he shall bring forth the headstone of it with shoutings, crying, Grace, grace unto it." So here's a rhetorical question. Who art thou, O mountain? If it is not by my might nor by my power as a priest or a king or both together, if this insurmountable, impossible task is to be accomplished, if the mountain is so high that nobody can get over it, who is this mountain? Who art thou, O great mountain? Who art thou, great difficulties? Who is going to stand between us and God? If God is for us, who can be against us? Before Zerubbabel thou shalt become a plain, the mountain shall be leveled. And that, of course, the mountain of difficulty, and that, of course, is what John is talking about. John the Baptist, when he comes to announce the coming of the Messiah, and he says, the high places shall be leveled, and the crooked places shall be made straight, for the traveling of the feet of the Messiah. And he shall bring forth the headstone of it with shoutings. Now the headstone is the top stone. Just like as I had put on this board before in a little drawing, an arch with the keystone at the top that holds it together. The headstone is the keystone, or if it's a building, the headstone is the last stone laid, the one on the top, which means the thing is going to be finished. He shall bring forth the headstone. Zerubbabel will get this temple built. He will get this job done. And it will be done with shoutings, crying, grace, grace unto it. Now be careful here, because this doesn't have anything to do with the grace of God for salvation. This is simply an expression, and it's kind of a Hebrew idiom, which means how beautiful, how graceful, how lovely is the temple which has been built when the last stone is placed upon the top of it. This is his vision. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. His hand shall also finish it, and thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me unto you. Now let me turn to the book of Revelation to give you just a little more information about these two olive trees. I say another word or two about that. The 11th chapter of Revelation. And it was given me a reed like unto a rod, and the angel stood, saying, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar, and them that worship therein. But the court which is without the temple, leave out, measure it not, for it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. And I will give power unto my two witnesses. Now this is written 600 years later. I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days, 3.5 years, the period of the great tribulation, clothed in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the God of the earth. And if any man will hurt them, fire proceedeth out of their mouth and devoureth their enemies. And if any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed. These have power to shut heaven, that it rain not in the days of their prophecy, and have power over waters to turn them to blood, etc., etc. So there in Revelation is mentioned the two witnesses. Now, I have said that the two witnesses are Joshua and Zerubbabel, the priest and the king, in 520 B.C. When we, 600 years later, when John has his vision, he sees these same two olive trees. And he doesn't tell us who they are, but he describes them. And the way he describes them makes it very obvious that what he's talking about is the reappearance of Moses and Elijah. Not Joshua and Zerubbabel, but Moses and Elijah. Now be careful, because we don't believe in reincarnation, and that's not what he's talking about in Revelation. It's not the reincarnation of two men. It is rather the reemergence of the spirit of these two men. And these two men represented Moses, the law, and Elijah, the prophets. Now, in the Old Testament, in 520, God had two witnesses. One was a priest, one was a king. At the end of the age, God will have two witnesses. One will be the representative of the law, and one will be the representative of the prophets. So, as I have suggested to you so many times in our study of prophecy, at the end, for the nation of Israel, everything will revert back to the way it was in 70 A.D. when the nation was destroyed by Titus of Rome. Since that time, the nation of Israel has been scattered and dispersed, and the church has filled in this interval of time, this parenthesis of time, as God's means of bringing salvation to the world. But one day God's going to come back, and he's going to do again with Israel what he started to do when they rejected the Messiah. He's going to come back. And when he comes back to do this, everything will be just like it was then, which means the law and the prophets and the priest and the king will be in effect again. Also, I think I ought to say that the two witnesses are not always the same throughout history. But God has never left himself without witness. And so there are always two witnesses which are necessary in order to witness anything and give an adequate guarantee or proof of what is said as being true. According to the scriptures, you have to have two or three witnesses in order to do that. Now let's move on. For who hath despised the day of small things? And this was a very small thing which they were doing, the beginning again of the nation. Just a few people going back and building an altar and building a little rough, crude kind of temple. For they shall rejoice and shall see the plummet in the hand of Zerubbabel with their seven. The plummet was a lead bob that was used by builders in ancient times to get a right angle. Sometimes we still use a bob you hang it on a string, and it will be absolutely right angled to what's level down here, so you can get it, you can get a 90-degree out of it. But it simply means that you will see Zerubbabel at work because he'll have the plummet in his hand. With those seven, they are the eyes of the Lord, and there's the reference again, which run to and fro through the whole earth. Then answered I and said unto him, what are these two olive trees upon the right side of the lampstand, upon the left side of it? Because you see, the angel of the Lord, or the interpreting angel who's doing the talking here, has not actually told him that it's Zerubbabel and Joshua. We gather that from the context. And I answered again and said unto him, what are these two olive branches which through the two golden pipes empty the golden oil out of themselves? And he answered me and said, knowest thou not what these are? Do you not know what this is? You ought to know what this is. The angel of the Lord, the interpreting angel rather, is kind of rubbing it in here. And Zechariah keeps saying, but I don't. I just don't. I told you at the beginning of our study that I would mention it again and again. The one thing you have to keep in your mind in the study of any of the books of prophecy, especially Zechariah here, is that the prophet always said more than he understood. That's why he was a prophet. He wasn't just talking. He wasn't just preaching a sermon on Sunday morning that he'd gotten up late on Saturday night. He was presenting what God told him to say, and he didn't understand it. The prophet always said more than he understood. And he answered me and said, knowest thou not what these are? And I said, no, my Lord. Then said he, these are the two anointed ones that stand by the Lord of the whole earth. And I said, I think God has his witnesses in every generation. In this case, we know who they were, the king and the priest. But remember that these two witnesses who cannot take any credit for what they are able to do as representative of God among the nation, that's already been pointed out to us because we are told that it is not by might nor with power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts. Remember that these two, the king and the priest, in a real finite, final sense, represent the coming Messiah, who will be what? Both king and priest of the nation of Israel. He is our high priest, and he's coming again as King of Kings and Lord of Lords to be the king of the earth as well as the high priest, which he already is. He is the high priest now, but he is the designate king, king designate, and he will one day be the incumbent king when he returns again to the earth. Since we only have about 3 minutes left in our 45-minute segment, I think this is the place to stop and not get into chapter 5, where he talks about his next vision, which is the vision of the flying scroll. And that's very interesting, too, as I think you found all of this is interesting. So when we come back to our next session, we will look at chapter 5 and some of the sections following that.